Welcome to CoreCast, a production of National Community Renaissance, a nonprofit affordable housing developer dedicated to solving the housing challenges facing seniors, veterans, and low-income families in America. CoreCast is designed to expand interest in the area of affordable housing, as well as interview problem solvers and explore solutions to our housing challenges. Welcome into the National Core Studios for the latest edition of CoreCast. I'm your host, Jonathan Kendrick, and joined as usual with Steve Pontell, the President and CEO of National Community Renaissance. Steve, how are you today?
Good. Thank you, Jonathan.
Glad to have you back here with us, and we have a very exciting, packed show for you today. We have, as usual, Michael Novogradic will join us a little bit later with the highlights from his Tax Credit Tuesday podcast, and a lot going on in his world, and we're excited to hear him share. And we're also really excited to have Ben Metcalf, California's State Housing Director, on the podcast today to talk about the state's new housing assessment and some of the fallout from that. So we're excited to bring him on a little bit later. But as we always do, we start off with the water cooler segment, where Steve and I discuss some of the latest goings on in the world of housing and other related topics. And Steve, it's been really an interesting time for housing, both at the national and the state and local levels recently. And we'll start in Washington, D.C. There's been an election, and there, as President Obama has said in the past, elections have consequences, and that is, for, I think, for every industry, and housing included. And we at National Core have been kind of thinking through that recently, some of the opportunities with the new administration and just a new group in town. So what are some of the things that you're thinking about as a new administration starts to look at our state of housing in the country, and especially affordable housing that we deal with on a day-to-day basis?
Thank you, Jonathan. Well, first, you know, there's been a lot of conversation about the nomination of Dr. Carson to be secretary and of HUD, and we should know within the next few days or weeks whether that nomination goes forward. We assume it will. My own personal opinion is I think it could be a very good thing, because unfortunately, housing has not been a very high-profile issue. And although we've had a number of secretaries of HUD that have been highly competent and technically competent and professionals in the housing arena, they haven't necessarily brought a high profile to the issue. And I think Dr. Carson, number one, be able to do it as a personality that is now fairly well known, and then secondarily, the ability to link housing to other critical issues such as health and education, I think, can also be strengthened under Dr. Carson's leadership. And so I have a lot of optimism that the new secretary and HUD will be able to have a more important, more effective role in helping our nation to meet its needs. However, having said that, I do think there are some opportunities that, you know, the philosophy of the administration can also help with, you know, maybe bringing a more competitive approach to the development of housing, maybe some more creativity and flexibility in what unfortunately is often a very expensive and bureaucratic process. And so I'm overall excited about what can be. Time will tell to see how everything plays out.
As we look at kind of the state of the nation's public housing, Dr. Carson has made some comments in his confirmation hearing and elsewhere about looking at some public-private partnerships and ways to preserve and expand the housing available to low-income families in the United States. What are some of your thoughts on how the administration can go about doing that, and your thoughts on the idea?
Sure. Well, we have built up over the years a fairly rigid, you could call it monopolistic, public housing infrastructure across the country. And so anything we can do to introduce more flexibility, freedom, and competition on the public housing side, I think could be very beneficial. And completely understanding that the states have a significant role in the creation of public housing authorities, you know, I think HUD could send some strong signals, essentially freeing public housing authorities up from any geographic constraints and even legal constraints of being governmental agencies, allowing them to merge with nonprofits you know, allowing the big ones to grow and, you know, trying to facilitate mergers and acquisitions and, you know, within that arena, because in the housing game, scale matters. And one of the questions is, how do we develop an affordable housing development infrastructure that can scale up to meet the demand, which is millions and millions of units nationwide that have to be produced? The current production of affordable housing is not even scratching the growing need. So every year the deficit of affordable housing gets bigger and bigger. If we don't do something dramatic to transform how we're producing housing, then essentially we're not going to be making any ground. And so I think there's some principles along those lines that could be thought about. We're big supporters of RAD. We think RAD needs some updating and some updated rents and support as far as the reality of various markets. We're big supporters of MTW, the move to work agencies. The more flexibility that can be given to public housing authorities, we think the better.
I want to go back to the health and housing connection you talked about a little bit earlier, and it's something that we focused on quite a bit at National Core over the last few years. And having now Dr. Carson, a lifelong physician and neurosurgeon, potentially to lead HUD as the secretary, what are some of the ideas, the possibilities that you see in health care, health insurance, healthy living, all these types of areas of health that can be integrated with housing? And how do you see that playing out?
Sure. Thanks, Jonathan. You know, there have been a steady stream of studies that demonstrate what a critical role housing plays in the health of people. And, you know, the easiest way to think about it is being a homeless is not a very healthy lifestyle. And so there are various degrees of shelter above homelessness that similarly do not facilitate health. And the primary way that families and people deal with the housing shortage is with overcrowding. And so overcrowding also does not promote health. And so the opportunity for housing is, to the extent the health community really embraces the need for housing as a way to deal with the health challenges that we have as a country, then we believe that that'll give housing a significant boost. Because health being 17, 18, 19% of our entire gross domestic product, and health being one of the most critical issues being discussed, to the extent housing gets added into that equation, then it can have a significant impact on the production of housing. And to the extent we do produce not only the right quantity but the right quality of housing, the positive health effects on our population as a whole would be tremendous. Reducing other costs, reducing the cost of the use of emergency room, reducing the cost of asthma, reducing the, you know, all of the various costs that go with the negative health consequences of an inadequate supply of housing. It's something that we as a country should, number one, know the cost, and then just do the math on what the impact of a housing shortage is.
You've also mentioned in the past a similar connection between housing and education. What are some of the thoughts, you know, that you've had, the National Core has had, on the relationship between housing and education and similar policy ideas that could be helpful in bringing those separate sectors together as well?
Sure. I mean, one of the, you know, similarly studies have shown children that are unstably housed have poorer educational performance than children that are stably housed. And so at the end of the day, there are millions of kids across the country that are living in very unstable shelter conditions, whether it's motels, cars, couch surfing, whatever the case may be. And their educational performance, you know, at various points throughout their life is going to determine their alternative futures. And so we as a society, once again, are going to bear the cost of underperforming citizens as a result of the housing shortage that currently exists. And so to the extent, as with health, if the education community becomes strong advocates for housing as a way to improve educational performance, then the opportunity to see housing initiatives move forward, I think, will be that much greater. And to the extent we care about our kids and we care about the future of our communities, we need to care that people have adequate shelter. And it's irresponsible that we as a society have allowed the shelter situation to deteriorate to the point that it is today.
And nowhere has that shelter deterioration, lack of shelter, more evident in the United States than in our home state of California.
Absolutely.
We'll hear from Ben Metcalf a little bit later in the podcast. You know, the statewide housing assessment that California just released paints a really bleak picture of where we're at as a state. You know, home ownership at the lowest rate since the 1940s, 1.5 million low-income Californian households paying more than 50% of their income in rent, lack of supply of 100,000 units per year. That's going to cause, I think the number is $240 billion hole in the economy, or holding back the economy at that level. And, you know, we're starting to hear, I think this year and maybe a little bit last year, finally, the issue is starting to rise. And so just, you know, some of the things in this new legislative session in Sacramento, and they've introduced a $3 billion statewide housing bond. They've brought back a call for a recording fee on real estate documents to establish an ongoing fee for affordable housing. Even in the last week or so, we've heard a couple of interesting initiatives from the Chan Zuckerberg Foundation. Mark Zuckerberg, the founder of Facebook, putting $3.6 million, a smaller amount, but he's a high-profile guy, into some housing-related issues. John Chung, one of the candidates for governor when the next cycle comes around, has announced that part of his running for office is going to include some sort of affordable housing ballot initiative. And so, Steve, as you start to hear these ideas, one, are you noticing, as I have, the drumbeat getting louder? And then, two, are we any closer to starting to get some policy prescriptions to solve the problem?
Yeah, I think it would be hard for any elected official or agency leader to not acknowledge the crisis of shelter that we have in California, and it's at all levels. You know, the not only at the end of the spectrum dealing with the growing homelessness, but the young millennials and, you know, young workers in the workforce and their inability to be able to find housing anywhere proximate to their jobs. And you can go through each life stage and each sector and identify the consequences of the shortage of housing, and people can no longer deny it. The challenge I think we have, though, is there's not enough money on the planet to build subsidized housing for everybody in California that needs housing. And so the only way we're going to solve the problem in California and nationally is to the extent the market is able to produce housing that people can afford for the bulk of the population. And so that's the delta that we need to understand. We know what the cost of land is. We know what the cost of construction is. We know what the cost of permits are. We know what the cost of developer fees are. So we know what the cost is. We know how much money people make. And we know how much they can afford for housing. So we know what the difference is between the cost and what they can afford. If we don't bend the cost curve in a way that gets housing to be affordable, naturally affordable, then we're just going to be playing on the margins of the issue. There will always be segments of the population that need subsidy. So we need the dollars for subsidy. You know, whether it's developmentally disabled or people that, you know, have various issues that are contributing to them being chronically homeless, you know, there's always a population that's going to need a subsidy, but the only way we really solve California's problem is if the market can produce housing that the market can afford.
We've talked about the issues at the federal and state level, but Steve, you often talk about that most of the housing-related decisions are made at the local level. And, you know, looking at a couple ideas that have come out recently and some things on the ballot coming up in the Los Angeles area, Senator Scott Wiener just got elected into the California legislature, and he's been discussing some ideas of starting to put some teeth to California's regional housing needs assessment to, in some areas, mandate that cities provide housing. So far, there's been kind of almost a suggestion that cities need to, but there's no real backup to enforcing that. There's also, you know, Governor Brown introduced in the last session his Buy Right proposal, which would also, you know, have cities, once all the proper approvals were in place, you know, the project would then move forward. Cities have a review in that, but wouldn't allow it to be revisited multiple times. And your thoughts on that, cities and their role in, you know, planning for their own communities, but also each city needing to step up to do their part in alleviating the housing crisis.
Yeah, great observation. I mean, my belief is cities have 90% of the discretion and the authority to make housing happen at a price point that people can afford. It's just cities have to want to do it. They have to have the political will to be able to accomplish it. And for those cities that understand that, they can get things done, they can make things happen. The biggest single obstacle cities have, though, is the structure of local governments, fiscal support, being dependent on sales tax for their primary discretionary dollars, forces cities to play the sales tax chasing game, and then not perceiving economic value for the various agencies themselves in the production of housing keeps them away from producing housing. And so I cities need to step up for the sake of their residents or the children of their residents, or maybe more importantly, the grandchildren of their residents. But ultimately, if we don't restructure local government finance, cities will not be able to move in the volume necessary to get things done. And so my hope is that Sacramento doesn't just look at, the way to try and force cities to do something, but actually thinks holistically about, financially, how can a city survive and provide the necessary housing at a price point that people can afford.
A couple of those local ballot initiatives that are coming up just next month in the March elections in the LA area. There's one in LA County that's proposing a 25-cent county sales tax for 10 years to fund homeless services and prevention. That's Measure H. And that would be about $350 million annually. That comes right after in November the voters approved in the city $1.2 billion bond to deal with some of the homeless issues. So there's some funding opportunities there on one side for homelessness, and on the other is this Measure S. And in our last podcast, we talked with Rick Cole. They had a similar measure on the ballot in Santa Monica, and about the dangers of ballot box planning at the time. And the yes vote on Measure S would impose a moratorium on construction that increases development density for up to 2 years, prohibits project-specific amendments to the city's general plan, and requires city staff, not developers, to perform environmental impact reports. Your thoughts on these two initiatives, Steve, as kind of a general, view on these throughout different jurisdictions that we've seen a lot of recently?
Sure. The dollars, there's a lot of interest in solving the homeless problem because it's now become so visible. And so the dollars that are being talked about could start to make a difference in trying to address the current need. But ultimately, the ripple effect of the lack of housing at every price point will continue to drive a certain amount of the homeless population. And so if we really want to cut that off, we have to deal with housing at other price points as well. So, but the ballot initiatives, I would definitely support them because the dollars are necessary. When we eliminated redevelopment, we took $1 billion a year out of the affordable housing industry. And so to the extent there's the opportunity to produce necessary projects for very targeted populations, I think that's important. But I just going back to our last podcast, I think ballot box planning and land use decision making is a disaster because it can never be as thorough, complete, as a specific process that takes into consideration all of the consequences. So it's my sincere hope that Measure S fails, and that the processes within the various jurisdictions, in this case the city of LA, can be strengthened to protect neighborhoods and produce necessary housing.
Thanks, Steve. And next up on our podcast, we're excited to welcome in Ben Metcalf, the Director of California's Department of Housing and Community Development. Before that role, he was appointed to that role back in November of 2015 by Governor Jerry Brown. He came to California from the U.S. Department of Housing and Urban Development, HUD, where he was the Deputy Assistant Secretary in the Office of Multifamily Housing Programs. Before that, he was out here with a fellow nonprofit developer, Bridge Housing Corporation, and he has had quite an experience in this area. And we're happy to have him on today to talk about California's recently released statewide housing assessment entitled California's Housing Future: Challenges and Opportunities.
I'm very pleased pleased and honored to have Ben Metcalf here with me today. Ben is the director of the Housing and Community Development Department for the state of California. Welcome, Ben.
Hey, Steve. Happy to be here.
Thank you. And so today, it's actually now been a few months since the state issued a report on some of the challenges and opportunities for California's housing crisis. But Ben, why don't we start with maybe, if you wouldn't mind, just give a brief introduction of yourself and then a little bit of background on HCD.
Sure, happy to do that. So I am now just coming up on my 1 year mark since starting as director of Department of Housing and Community Development. I'm happy to be here and enjoying the work. By way of background, I come here most recently from Washington, D.C., where I spent 6 years working at the federal level at the Department of Housing and Urban Development, most recently running HUD's Office of Multifamily Housing Programs. And in that capacity, did a lot of work with the FHA Insured Lending Program, a lot of work with HUD's Rental Assistance Programs, and had the chance to collaborate on a couple of initiatives that work directly with HCD. So I had a little bit of a sense of what I was getting from that perspective. But I'm also a California native. I grew up out here, grew up in the Bay Area, and before I went into government, I had worked for quite a few years with Bridge Housing Corporation, a statewide nonprofit housing developer. Every project I worked on when I was at Bridge touched HCD funding programs. So I've also had the experience of working with HCD as a partner, a practitioner partner. So all that said, of course, when I landed into this job almost a year ago, I discovered there was a heck of a lot that I didn't know about HCD, and I've spent most of the past year just trying to get up to speed. In addition to running a number of loan and grant programs that support primarily multifamily housing, and these include both sort of state bond programs as well as federal pass-through funds, some of it's community development and infrastructure funds, some of it's homeless pass-through dollars, some of it are for our flagship programs like for vets and for under the cap and trade. We also have a big codes division that makes recommendations and changes to the building code standards. We oversee mobile home parks up and down the state of California. And we're working closely with planning departments in every jurisdiction in California, implementing state housing law that requires us to review and approve every jurisdiction's housing elements. So there's a lot of work that goes in here, but I've discovered it's a great team and a lot of great opportunities to make a difference for housing in California.
Great. Yeah, I mean, it's interesting because obviously local government has a significant amount, if not the majority, of both the opportunity and the responsibility to address the housing needs in California. And so the whole state-local government partnership is an interesting dance, I'm sure, going back and forth.
Yeah, it is. I mean, we have a lot of points of intersection with local governments now. I mean, there's a whole body of state housing law that has emerged over a period of decades that implicates the state in, you know, approving and funding and overseeing planning that happens not just at the local level, but obviously at the regional level. So we do a lot of work with regional governments, helping them think about their regional sustainable communities strategies. We do a lot of work with local governments, helping them make sure that they're, you know, properly accommodating all the residential housing need that the law says they have to plan for, and implementing all kinds of state laws that override or inform local decision making around things that range from, you know, accessory dwelling units to density bonus law, and on and on.
Sure. So the HCD recently released a study identifying some of the challenges and opportunities having to do with housing in California. Maybe give a little bit of an introduction to that project.
Sure. I'm really proud of this one. This is one, a report that the department has not produced, at least at this level of comprehensiveness, since 2000, the Raising the Roof study, which some of your listeners may be familiar with. We have done updates to the Raising the Roof over the last 15 years, but really this is the first time that we've put pen to paper and really tried to lay out in a comprehensive way the full scope and spectrum of housing affordability issues in California. So really looking at the full body of research around what does it look like to buy or rent a home in rural areas and urban areas, multifamily, single family. What are the challenges that are particularly pronounced for certain kinds of vulnerable populations? What are the existing suite of programs that are available to help address that? And then furthermore, to actually take all that research and all those findings about what the breadth of the housing crisis is and try and lay out a policy framework for how we address the need that we know we'll have over the next 10 years between now and 2025. And we have listed out a long list of policy options that can be exercised by state or local policymakers. And where we are right now is we're actually in the middle of workshopping this document. So we are out going up and down the state. I was just down in Los Angeles last Friday. We actually have a workshop today in Sacramento. We're going to be out in Oakland next week, trying to get as much public comment as we possibly can, both to inform the research and findings, as well as to help us better articulate the policy responses.
Sure, and it's interesting. One of the challenges that's identified is just looking at the last 10 years where production has averaged less than 80,000 units and the need has been estimated at 180,000 units per year. Just focusing maybe on the whole supply shortage and obviously the ripple effect of the supply shortage on the affordability of housing, do you see any initiatives on the horizon that might be able to bend that production curve so that it starts chipping away at the lack of supply?
Well, let me just start by saying, I mean, you really nailed it. I mean, that number, that production level was eye-opening for me. I mean, I feel like I've become a little bit inured sometimes to how bad the housing situation is because I spent so much time thinking about it and talking about it. But the research finding that we are on track to do less than half of the construction that we need is particularly eye-opening, especially when you put it side by side with the fact that historically, and not even that deep history, I mean, a history that many of us can remember back in the 80s, 70s, 60s, we were producing closer to 200,000 units a year. So, you know, the state has been capable of producing the number of homes we know it needs. Back in a time when our population was much lower, we just simply haven't been able to do that over the last 20, 25 years, and it's been particularly bad since the downturn. We've really never gotten back out since the downturn in 08. All that said, I am an optimist, I suppose. I do think that we can, and what this report tries to do is, tries to articulate the reasons why really a combination of policies have been put in place at the local level and not the state level that have restricted supply. And we can look to examples of cities that have bucked the trend and look to emulate those best practices. We can also look to some of the work that's been done by neighboring states or neighboring jurisdictions. And I think here particularly of some of the work that's gone on in places like the state of Washington, Seattle, to really encourage development. That is much more robust. So bottom line is, yes, I do think there are examples of ways that we can make progress and that there are examples of cities and jurisdictions both within and outside of California that are making it work.
Sure, and last year, one of the discussions was the governor's proposed Buy Right initiative. Do you anticipate it? And my understanding was essentially, one of the greatest challenges to the production of housing is the level of uncertainty that exists in the development process. And my understanding of the theory is to the extent you go through the local process and get approval, you would have a higher degree of certainty that your project would be able to move forward. And that was kind of the goal. But obviously there was some opposition to that. Have there been recent conversations about trying to resurrect that theory to see if there's a way to add some certainty into the process?
Yeah, so something in that vein, I think, is in the mix again. The governor did move forward a very particular legislative policy last session, which was called the Buy Right Proposal. It came out as part of his May revised budget. It went through the budget process, and as part of the budget deal that was signed, there was sort of conceptual agreement to make that law and to package with it a one-time chunk of general fund dollars. As you say, it didn't actually make it over the finish line. We were unable to kind of get to agreement on the particulars of how that bill would work. I think there was sort of conceptual agreement that at its core there was a good idea there, that if a jurisdiction had done the planning work already, that if it wasn't an infill location, that if there was some affordability, that there ought to be some way to have more certainty and to move those kind of projects through faster. But it didn't get there last session. This session, the governor has not reintroduced that specific policy. Instead, what he did in his budget statement a few weeks ago was he basically laid out a series of principles of things that he wanted to be taken up in any package of housing bills that move this year, and gave his commitment to the legislature to work with them to make it happen. But here, I think this year, the hope is that the legislature, through normal legislative processes, will come up and develop some bills which can then come back to the governor without the governor having to advance a proposal on his own. The principles that he laid out are similar to some of the very much spring from the conversations we had in May. They very much build off of the statewide housing assessment framework and draft that was released just prior to the budget release. But they basically say that any kind of housing work we do this session, it has to include some way to make the approval and entitlements process go a little bit smoother and have a little more certainty. There needs to be some attention to cost and how we lower per unit cost of housing in California. We need to look at how we can incentivize jurisdictions to want to approve more housing, right? What are the ways in which we can make jurisdictions rewarded, either by linking other funds or finding other opportunities that make it worth their while to approve housing? We also need to have better accountability measures. We have good and progressive state housing laws on the books, but we know that jurisdictions sometimes aren't following them and that nobody's really tracking and holding them accountable for that. So we need to figure out ways to make the compliance end work. And then lastly, his package presumes that there will be some kind of funding also that gets included in that package. And his request is that when we think about funding, we think about doing it not on a one-time or one-off basis, but as a permanent and durable source of funding that draws from a protected non-general fund source.
Sure. And, it's interesting when you think about local government, it's not complicated. It's really hard, but it's not complicated. I mean, cities play the cards they're dealt, and they're incented to chase retail dollars, which is why we have an overproduction of retail and an overzoning of retail. They're not incented to produce housing. And so
exactly. At
the end of the day, that structure of local government finance seems to be one of the biggest impediments to getting cities on board to really push for the production of housing.
That's right.
Yeah, so so that is kind of an interesting challenge. And then to the specific issue of subsidized housing, which in my mind, it's there's two different. One is the affordability of housing writ large, and then the second is, for the most vulnerable people within our population, they need some form of subsidy, not to, dredge ancient history now, but we've not done a good job thinking about replacing the $1 billion a year that was lost to the affordable housing industry with the elimination of redevelopment, and which has had obviously a dramatic effect on the number of units being produced. How we are able to put together the necessary resources for the production of subsidized housing continues to be an interesting challenge. Do you think it's Senate Bill 2 by Senator Atkins is her next attempt at coming back in with a transaction fee of some sort? Do you see something like that moving?
Yeah, I do. I think the senator has done really good work trying to find a way to deliver a bill that can get the two-thirds vote that'll need to get in both chambers to get to the governor's desk. I think there's some sense that with the larger Democratic majorities in both chambers in this current legislative session, that may be helpful. We now have two-thirds Democrats in both chambers. But I think kind of anything that has any kind of a fee or tax is going to be met with some just reflexive skepticism, particularly by moderate Democrats, let alone by Republicans. So I think that that bill does have a good chance of moving forward. I think certainly the extent which it's wrapped with a larger package of reforms will actually help, not hurt. Encouraged by that, I would, you know, obviously have to caution here. I mean, you talked about $1 billion a year that we're trying to maybe plug a hole here. You know, this bill won't do that. It is a little bit narrower. It only is $75 document recording fee on, as currently written, on refinance transactions. We know with interest rates going up, we're going to see a pretty low volume of refinances over the next few years. So it may be that this is really more like a $200 million a year, at least as drafted today in the initial years of implementation. But just to go back to the original point, you know, I think we have to figure out, you know, whether it's Atkins bill or something else. I mean, that's exactly what we need to be looking at, is additional money that we can put out there for the most vulnerable, to support the most vulnerable populations. But we also, I mean, the governor has been great on this. I mean, we also can't look to subsidy to solve all of California's housing woes. There are today 1.5 million, that's a breathtakingly large number, 1.5 million low-income households in California that are paying more than half their income every month in housing costs. And, you know, a lot of that is because of the overall supply shortage has had folks up the income distribution, sort of outbidding these lower income households for units that in a more rational environment, you know, they'd be able to access affordably. So until we can kind of make more supply available up the distribution, we're going to have an increasing number of low income households, you know, competing over the same very finite pool of subsidized housing units. And so in an ideal world, we're really using that subsidy much more tactically in a targeted fashion for a smaller universe and relying on the market to do what the market has done historically in California, again, going back to the 70s and 80s, which is to provide what we think of as workforce housing that doesn't require any subsidy but still serves low-income households.
Right, right. And that's a great segue into kind of my last area of question, which is, you know, the costs that are both the opportunity but the costs that are not counted as a result of this shortage of housing. And so the primary way people respond to the shortage of housing is living in overcrowded circumstances. And so if you deny, you know, design a neighborhood for 100 people and you have 200 people living there, the roads, water, sewer, police, fire, parks, schools all deteriorate faster than they were designed for. So by not having an adequate supply of housing, we're, you know, functionally destroying all of our neighborhoods. And we don't have the additional tax revenue from the additional units if we had the units, nor the additional investment in necessary infrastructure if we had those additional units. Instead, you know, infrastructure is undersized. And so the linkage of the cause and effect, and kind of my last question gets into one of the comments in the report having to do with, you know, greater interagency coordination. One of the drums that, you know, I keep beating is until healthcare cares about housing as a critical social determinant of health, and until education cares about housing as a critical determinant of educational performance, et cetera, you know, the housing conversation by itself will never be able to really move the agenda either at the local level or at the statewide level. And so one of the things that if we can get, you know, the other aspects of the community, whether it's law enforcement, health, transportation, education, et cetera, to all agree that housing is absolutely at the center of a lot of the breakdowns in our current systems, you know, it's going to be that much harder to move the bar. Do you see much progress of that, or is there any way we can help you kind of carry that message forward?
See, I couldn't agree more. I think you just articulated both the crux of the problem and the ultimate, you know, one of the ultimate paths for success here. I think we have to keep, as you say, beating those drums. And the data is right there. The data is in our reports that things like housing instability, which becomes increasingly pronounced when the affordability crisis grows, the number of times, you know, a poor family is evicted because they, you know, can't meet rent because they had to go fix up their car, or, you know, they were evicted because they were overcrowded and they weren't complying with the lease. Those things directly correlate into negative outcomes for kids because the data is clear that when you are forced to move multiple times, this is just intuitive. As a parent, you know, we understand this. If you're moving from school to school, your kids aren't going to be able to perform. Same thing on health. We We see, particularly as the homeless population grows in California, which is a direct consequence of the housing crisis, that more folks are living on the streets without accessing appropriate medical care, that they are using emergency rooms as a default solution, and that is creating a major problem for Medi-Cal. So, and then I would, even more than that, I think we have, as Californians, to be very worried about what the research is showing us about reduced economic mobility, that, today, because of the housing crisis, it is measurably harder for low-income kids to access the middle class. That literally, the housing crisis is, foreclosing on the American dream. And we have to think about that, what we can do differently to make our case. I would say that we are moving in the right direction. I think if you look at where we actually made a lot of progress at the state level legislatively last session, it was in the area of homelessness. We were able to get $2 billion of new capital for permanent supportive housing. We did create a new interagency state coordinating council that includes the cabinet heads of all the related state agencies, the Department of Social Services, the Department of Healthcare Services, Workforce Investment Board. All these entities are now at the cabinet level, understanding that housing is key to their ability to be successful with this very vulnerable population. If you look at what we've done in terms of the Affordable Housing and Sustainable Communities Program, that we have the Strategic Growth Council. Now, we administer with HCD, side by side with the Air Resources Board to understand that those investments we make in housing directly translate into meeting the state's climate change goals and lowering greenhouse gases. So I think in every instance where we are trying to make progress in housing, we need to intentionally align with and ally ourselves with these larger communities of practitioners. Now that's hard. Somebody who's doing the work in government, there's a risk we become completely tied up in, committee work or something like that. But it is the right direction, and I'm pleased we're taking some really important steps in that vein.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, you're right. It is, it is hard because the silos are tall, or the towers of excellence are tall, and the walls are thick. And it's totally rational because every single issue is incredibly complicated. So water people talk to water people, and transportation people,
right,
transportation people, et cetera. But if we don't figure out a way to think about the system as a whole, everybody's going to be losing. And so I very much appreciate your work. And it's great to have you as a partner at HCD. And so our encouragement is to get people to get out to the workshops on the California's Housing Future Challenges and Opportunity Report, and continue to provide feedback. And anything we can do, Ben, to help you move forward any of the goals, we stand ready to assist.
Thank you. Yeah, no, I encourage listeners out there to check out our website, hcd.ca.gov. We have a link there to all of our workshops and public comment process for the statewide housing assessment. We really do value your input. And Steve, I want to thank you, too, and your National Core for the leadership you've provided on these issues. I just appreciate what you've been doing, whether it's working with regional governments yourself down in Southern California, or just getting out and helping tell the message. You guys are doing quality work there, and you are stepping up to push us on the policy front as well, and I'm grateful for that.
Very good. Thank you very much. We'll look forward to seeing you soon.
Will do.
Hello, I'm Michael Novogradic, the managing partner of Novogradic & Company, LLP. We're a national CPA firm specializing in tax, audit, and consulting services for tax credit-assisted developments, especially multifamily affordable rental housing. I'm here today to share with you some affordable housing news highlights that were featured over the past month in my weekly Tax Credit Tuesday podcast. If you're ready, let's get started. In affordable housing news, the California Tax Credit Allocation Committee, or TCAC, in February changed its proposal to allow a hybrid 9% and 4% low-income housing tax credit, or LIHTC, structure. The original proposal was in reaction to the disruption in the LIHTC equity market that's making it difficult for some transactions to close financing gaps and start construction. TCAC proposed an option of a hybrid structure for 2016 awardees of LIHTCs. After some deliberation, TCAC made the hybrid structure an option for both 2016 second-round awardees and any first-round awardees whose developments haven't closed construction financing. Now, awardees who want to restructure to the hybrid approach must submit a revised 9% application and a new 4% application to TCAC. They must also submit a bond allocation application to the California Debt Limit Allocation Committee. All those applications must be turned in by March 13th. TCAC also extended the readiness closing deadlines for all 2016 second-round awardees to the latter of 2 months after the date given in its original reservation letter, or June 30th. Whether using the hybrid structure or not, TCAC will allow sponsors to return any 2016 credit reservations without receiving negative points. Sponsors can then reapply for 9% credits at a higher amount. In addition, all second-round new construction 9% developments and any property seeking a hybrid structure can reset their credit year to 2017 by exchanging 2016 credits for 2017 credits. This is in order to allow them to extend their place-in-service deadlines. TCAC also proposes to allow any development that resets the 2016 federal credits to also reset their state credits in order to be able to certificate the state credits. TCAC said that any regulation changes will be considered at a March 15th meeting of TCAC or perhaps an earlier special meeting. My partner Molly Odell in our San Rafael, California office notes the hybrid structure is complicated, but it's obviously worth considering for sponsors who are facing difficulty in closing their transactions. She notes it is significant that TCAC welcomed this idea that was generated from the public sector and is open to considering fresh ideas. We have a blog post about the complexities and challenges of the hybrid structure at www.novaco.com/blog. And of course, if you have questions about your property or need assistance with the upcoming March due date, for both the SIDLAC and TCAC applications, contact Molly Odell in our San Rafael office. In more news from the California Tax Credit Allocation Committee, the state agency issued a reminder that the 2016 annual tenant demographic data collection for all long-term housing tax credit properties in California must be submitted by March 17th. I'll say that again, 2016 tenant demographic data for California long-term housing tax credit properties is due March 17th. TCAC reported that as of early February, only 570 out of 3,500 California tax credit properties had submitted the required data. Failure to submit this data by the deadline can result in an uncorrected Form 8823 being sent to the IRS, up to 10 negative points in future tax credit rounds, or fines to the ownership of the property. If you have any questions about collecting and submitting tenant data, contact my partner Jim Kroger in our Walnut Creek, California office. Well, that brings me to the end of this report. For more tax credit news, tune into our weekly Tax Credit Tuesday podcast. It's available on iTunes and on the Novogratic website at www.novaco.com. This is Michael Novogratic. Thanks for listening.
And again, a big thank you to Michael Novogratic for his Tax Credit Tuesday highlights that he shares with us each month on CoreCast. That's really good information. We're thankful to Michael and the whole group over there at the Novogratic Company for all the work that they do for the housing industry. It's time to wrap up, and we do what we learned, as we do each month on the podcast. And I'll start. You know, Steve, it's been interesting how we've talked about the drumbeat for housing issues getting louder. And just I was going through this week and looking at some of the reports that have just been issued in the last 2 years. Just reading down, you know, we're talking today with Ben Metcalf about California statewide housing assessment that was done by the state's Department of Housing and Community Development. But a couple of years ago, the Legislative Analyst Office, they had a report called California's High Housing Costs, Causes and Consequences. GAG had their California Housing Summit. California Forward is calling for 1 million more homes in the state. McKinsey did a report, a toolkit to close California's housing gap, 3.5 million homes. Joel Kotkin has done a few reports on this. So it's very interesting that, you know, the data is there, the drumbeat is getting louder, you're hearing candidates start to talk about housing more and more, and it's encouraging, and hopefully it can lead to some solutions to the housing crisis, because we've seen what it's done holding back families, holding back the economy, and we're just hopeful that we can begin to solve this and proud for the role that National Core is playing in doing that. Steve, what did you learn this week?
Yeah, thank you, Jonathan. I think that I was very Yeah, I think Ben Metcalf is the right man at the right place at the right time, because not only does he have the developer's perspective and experience and the Washington, D.C. perspective and experience, you know, but now within the state government, he's able to be able to interpret and articulate, you know, how the different pieces fit together. And one of the things that we know is that housing is an incredibly complicated issue, and the state of California has to juggle a lot of priorities. And so Ben's ability to advocate for housing in the midst of competing priorities is something that I appreciate, and I think we all need to get back and support him whenever we can.
Well, thank you, Steve, for your time as always on CoreCast, and that will do it for another edition of CoreCast. You can find out more information about the work we're doing at www.nationalcore.org. You can subscribe to this podcast on iTunes, and we'd love to hear from you as well. If you have comments or feedback, questions on the show, please send me a note at jkendrick@nationalcore.org, jkendrick@nationalcore.org, and we'd love to incorporate that into our next show. Well, that will do it for this edition, and remember, together we transform lives and communities.